Monday. The day before, Bellona, like all the other ships and vessels in the squadron, had rigged church. Jack Aubrey could hardly have been called a religious man, but as well as his many superstitions, he also had his pieties. He revered the sound, if not the full implication, of the Book of Common Prayer, the lessons, and the usual psalms and readings. The other rituals, such as the inspection of the entire ship and every soul aboard her, clean, shaved, sober, and towing a given line, or rather seam, soothed his mind. And although today he didn't feel up to reading a sermon, he and all his people were perfectly satisfied with the even more usual articles of war, which, through immemorial use, had acquired ecclesiastical qualities of their own. It is true that there were obvious and extremely painful associations with the parish church at Woolcombe, but the great heave of the sea, the creak of the rigging, and the smell of tar put a great enough distance between the two, and it was not until he'd returned to his cabin that an unlucky shifting of some papers to make room for his prayer book showed him Sophie's letter clear, and the sense of desolation, fury, and extreme distress returned with even greater force. Jack Aubrey was on deck this Monday morning, having sent his breakfast away, 4 eggs untouched congealing in their butter, and he saw the Admiral's signal. The Charlotte was a talkative ship, and although this was usually thought a tiresome characteristic, it did give the signal officers a great deal of practice. And now he heard Callow read off the hoists almost as they appeared without referring to the book. The squadron was to proceed in line abreast on a west-southwesterly course under all plain sail, the Bellona at the southern tip. Yet the glass was dropping. The southern sky, or as much of it as could be seen under the low cloud, was wanting in promise. And the sea of this ebbing tide had some curious pallid streaks apparently rising from the depths. The first lieutenant and the master looked grave. Harding had dined with the Charlotte's wardroom the day before, and he'd learnt that this sweep was being carried out, primarily in order to find how fast and how accurately a signal could travel from one extremity of the line, the unusually widespread line, to the other and back again. Lord Stranraer had another admiral, an expert on signals, aboard as a guest. Presently they were all under way, and the line, after a great deal of nagging from the flag, was as straight on the surface of the ocean as the earth's curvature would allow. But this perfection didn't last. A little before dinner the Charlotte made the signal for the squadron to tack together, emphasized by a gun, and as far as could be seen it was obeyed with tolerable regularity right across the broad front, though a second gun seemed to show that at least one ship on the far eastern end had been slow, or had even missed the signal altogether. There was a good deal of murk over there. Another explanation was that the unknown ship, having already mixed its noonday grog, was so infuriated by this untimely order that it delayed out of mere bloody-mindedness. Having come about, the squadron made a fair board, quite time enough to eat their 1/4 pound of cheese, this was a banyan day, and then returned to the former course, though with a little more west in it. Easy sailing. But presently the weather thickened, and the sound of the wind in the rigging rose steadily until it had traversed a full octave. Jack called for preventer stays. "We shall soon be going home," said Harding to Miller, who now had the watch. And by home he meant that dismal stretch of sea off Keller's Island where the Admiral liked to shelter, when the sea, wind and rain threatened to become more outrageous than usual. "Reef topsails, Mr. Miller, if you please," said Jack. The t'gallants had disappeared long since, and even the Ringle, as trim as a duck away there to leeward, showed little more than a handkerchief on each mast and a third right forward. "Hands reef topsails," came the cry, and the sharp, cutting bosun's pipe. And as the men raced aloft, Jack, gazing over the larboard bow, caught hints of whiteness away down in the troubled grey, the growing sea, and its now much wilder crests. "Port your helm," he said quietly to Compton, the older of the two men at the wheel, a hand who knew him well and the tone of his voice. Compton and his mate eased the great plunging ship a trifle to starboard, opening Jack a view as he stood there swaying to the sea, the telescope to his good eye. A long pause, an electric tension on the quarter-deck, and right along the waist of the ship, filled with men who knew or knew of him. Then the first of a series of blinding squalls of mixed rain, sleet, and snow. And when it had passed, Callow said hesitantly, "Sir, I believe I saw Monmouth repeat, 'Tack, all together,' just before she vanished." Jack and his officers stared briefly eastward. "I see nothing," he said. "Did you make out any signal, Mr. Harding?" "None, sir." "Mr. Callow, make enemy in sight 2 leagues southwest by south heading northwest. Mr. Miller, shake out the reefs in the foretopsail. Sir, fore topmast staysail half in." He stepped over to the wheel, and with his eye on those remote flecks in the infinity of other greys and whiteness, all shifting incessantly, he set a course to intercept the vessel, the enemy, the very probable enemy. The ship's company, including those who had escaped from the sick berth along with their attendants, lined the side. If there were any so morose as to disbelieve the captain's implied declaration, they didn't mention it. From his early days as an astonishingly successful frigate captain, coming home with a tale of captured ships and a fortune in prize money, Jack had acquired the status of a mythical being, or something very like it, a being whose judgment in these matters couldn't be wrong, and any scepticism would have been most furiously resented. The event confirmed the believers in their creed. Within half an hour, the Chase, raised high on a towering wave, was seen to be a frigate wearing French colours, herself pursuing a merchantman. She was not a national ship, however, but one of those powerful fast-sailing privateers from Vannes or Lorient that were more deadly as commerce raiders than the regular men of war, and that were now making the most of what war was left to them, often running very extreme risks within miles of the Channel fleet. She was called Les Deux Frères, and so intent was she on her prey, already within long shot, but they far preferred boarding in case a ball causing a leak should spoil the cargo, that she didn't make out the Bellona, partly veiled in a squall for some minutes. On doing so, she instantly bore up, bringing the wind not right aft but on her quarter, her best point of sailing. At the same time, out of mere spite, she fired at the merchantman, and almost immediately set her flying jib. Little good did either do. The shot missed, and the sail blew out of its bolt rope. Still, she fled along, throwing a splendid bow wave, her heavy crew tending the sail with the utmost attention, and risking long shots at the 74 in the hope of wounding her sails and cutting up her rigging, conceivably knocking away a yard or a topmast. After all, the Deux Frères carried a by no means contemptible armament, including some carronades. But even more than that, every man and boy aboard knew that their last 3 captures in the chops of the Channel had made them the richest privateer afloat. She fled with the utmost zeal, therefore, almost as fast as the Ringle steadily there on her starboard bow just out of shot. She fled with all the earnest desire to preserve wealth and freedom that can be imagined, and with almost superhuman skill. But short of the Bellona being struck by lightning, a good deal was flashing above the low cloud cover, she had no chance. For the sea was rising. Minute by minute the crests were higher, the spume tearing away from their tops, and the hollows between them were deeper and wider. And in seas of this magnitude no frigate could outsail a well-handled ship of the line to windward of her, since in these deep valleys the frigate was becalmed, while the 74, which in any case could spread more sail, was not, or not entirely, and she retained the momentum of her 1,600 tons. "It's going to be a dirty night," said Jack to the officer of the watch. "Pray pass the word for the gunner." "Master Gunner," he went on. "We'll not touch the lower deck port lids, but it would be as well to ready the forward larboard 18-pounders. You drew them all yesterday, I believe?"
"So I did, sir."
"And you're quite happy about your tompions with all this wet about?"
"If any misses fire, sir,"
said the gunner, his rain-soaked old face grinning with delighted anticipation, "you may call me Jack Pudding." Then, the full horror of this remark striking home, he looked perfectly blank, his lips framing unspoken words. All conversation, all possible explanations were cut off by a freakish sea flooding green over the quarterdeck rail and surging aft, and before it had cleared, an even more freakish carronade ball from the Der Freer struck and shattered the Bellona's wheel, flinging the helmsman right and left unhurt. She put straight before the wind and offered to come up the other side, taken all aback. But she had right seamen aboard, and they, brailing up the mizzen topsail and starting the mainsheet, quickly brought her under control until the usual purchases to the tiller had been shipped, allowed the ship to be steered by orders called down to the hands on either side of the sweep. In the few minutes that all this took, the Der Freer forged ahead. But when they saw the Bellona filled and squared away with her upper deck ports open and the guns ran out, their hearts died within them. They abandoned the notion of crossing the Bellona's bows and raking her with all they could throw, abandoned it entirely, came up into the wind, struck her colours, and lay to. Jack edged the Bellona over to make something of a lee, sent the Ringle and the Blue Cutter with a well-armed prize crew aboard under Miller, telling him to make for Falmouth and send the frigate's master back with his officers and papers. "And be uncommon brisk, Mr. Miller. It'll be nip and tuck getting the boat aboard." Nip and tuck it was, with the wind increasing to such a shocking degree, and it took the whole of the afternoon to heave the cutter in. But at last it was done, and the boat made triply fast. Well before that, however, the Frenchman had been taken disconsolate below. Harding was tolerably fluent in French. And Jack, still on deck, said to the master, "Mr. Woodbine, it's time to steer for Keller's Island."
"Yes, sir."
"You don't seem happy, Mr. Woodbine."
"I'm happy about the prize, and I give you joy, sir. But was I in command, I should follow her into Falmouth. The bosun's just got a report that the main yard is probably sprung in the slings, the mizzen doubtful in the welding, the beakhead bulkhead is stove. We've not had an observation these last three watches, and I don't believe the blow has reached its full strength, no, sir, not by a very long chalk. It'll be a great while before Chips and his mates can give us a right wheel, and although steering with sheet and purchase is very well for a pleasant Saturday afternoon, it's bloody awkward, pardon me the expression, all night long, in a howling tempest bearing dead on Ushant and its cruel reefs. Imagine trying to avoid a wreck with such a wind and with such a helm. And wrecks there will be by wholesale before daylight." Woodbine had obviously been drinking. "We must do our best," said Jack, not unkindly. Their best they did, but it was not enough. Very late that night, the blow turned out to be one of those notorious turning winds. It headed them when they were no great way from Ushant, and there was no beating into it, even if the Bellona had had a full suit of storm canvas, intact masts, spars and rigging, and a fresh, full-fed crew. She had none of these things. The galley had been flooded in the graveyard watch. It had been all hands, right round the clock, and not a man had eaten anything but wet ship's bread since yesterday's dinner. The people were utterly exhausted, and the ship was making more water than the pumps could expel. A certain lightning in the east, and it was first day at last. And they had their bearings, Vega some time before, through the tearing clouds, and old Saturn. The sea, however, was no less, the wind even more contrary. Jack bore up at last and sailed for Corsand Bay. As it expected, there were two other ships from the offshore squadron already there, and one, with only a single lower mast still standing, from the inner. And they'd taken up all the available places. "I am sorry, Orb,"
Canterbury, said the Commissioner, an old friend, but there it is. However, Alexandria won't take long. It's only a few ribs gone and an ugly hole plugged with a great piece of rock. Wonderful how often that happens, ain't it? Almost makes you believe in guardian angels. And as soon as she's done, you shall have her place. But dear me, Bellona does call for a lot of patching up. So do you yourself, Aubrey. You look dead beat. Believe me, what you want is a hot body bath. The whole body immersed in hot water and kept there for 5 or even 10 minutes. It opens the pores amazingly. They have one at the George and will bring up boiling buckets in a trice. And after that, a thundering good breakfast and sleep for 12 hours. Certainly, sir, said Jack, the moment I've written my necessary letter to the Admiral. Fortunately, I have my tender to take it out to Ushant. That pretty little Chesapeake schooner that came in with you, I've been admiring her, not a hair out of place. But, of course, your letter to the Admiral must come first, as you say, and a note to dear Mrs. Aubrey as well, I dare say. Pray remember me very kindly to her. The Commissioner kissed his hand and walked off, chuckling. Jack sat at his table. Bellona, Khorsand Bay, November the 17th. My lord, I beg to acquaint you that His Majesty's ship Bellona suffered much in the severe gale of last night and this morning. The mizzenmast received a violent wrench and is sprung at the partners and elsewhere. The mainyard is also sprung. The mainsail, main topsail, the mizzen and fore storm staysail were blown to pieces. One of the starboard main chain plates drew, and the ship laboured so excessively in the trough of the sea and shipped so much more water than the pumps could carry off that it became absolutely necessary for her safety to bear away for this port, where I arrived in the forenoon. I have the honour to enclose the ship's defects and a copy of the log since receiving your last signal. I have the honour to be, my lord, etc. Log of the Bellona. 16th p.m. Strong breeze with heavy swell. Tacked ship as per signal. Lost sight of squadron in heavy and almost continuous squalls. Sighted strange sail in pursuit of British brig southwest by south 2 leagues. Pursued and took same when she proved to be Le Deux Frères of Lorient, privateer frigate of 28 12-pounders and 2 39-pound carronades, 174 men, Dumanoir master. Sent her into Falmouth, a valuable prize, having taken 2 homeward-bound Guineamen laden with gold dust and ivory, and an outward-bound snow carrying ship stores to Lisbon. At 10:30, strong gales with heavy squalls. Carried away starboard main brace and larboard main topsail sheet. Sail blew to pieces. Set a storm main and fore staysail. 17th a.m. At 6:30, the storm mizzen and fore staysail blew from the yard. Strong gales veering and backing irregularly. At 8:00, obliged to scuttle lower deck. Ship labouring very much and gained 6 inches on the pumps. At 8:15, the carpenter reported the mizzenmast was sprung in consequence of the vangs of the gaff giving way. At 8:30 was struck with the sea on the larboard quarter, stove in 11 of the main deck ports, half filled the main deck, and carried away the bulkheads of the wardroom. At 8:00, hard gales with violent squalls, carried away the chain plate of the foremast main shroud, bore up under a reefed foresail, saw a line of battleship lying to with her head to the southward, and her sails split and blowing from the yards. John Aubrey. Jack reread his letter, realized that the two parts didn't exactly coincide, but he was too stupid and heavy to deal with this, so he sanded, folded, addressed, and sealed it. He and Harding had already seen to the transfer of the Bellona's hands to receiving ships, and the few officers and midshipmen who didn't cling to what was left of their cabins and berth where they could at least get some sleep had found themselves lodgings. All he had to do now was to carry this letter to Reed or Callow, they alternated aboard the Ringle, and ask for it to be taken out to Ushant. But no sooner was the seal well in place than he clapped his hand to his forehead and whipped the letter open again, adding, My lord, I am sending you this letter by my tender, but at the present moment I'm so stupid after the night's blow that I forgot to beg that you would be so good as to send her back, as soon as you may find convenient. I have, as your lordship knows, a rendezvous at the Dark of the Moon, and if the repairs to Bellona cannot be carried out by then, I should wish to keep the engagement in Ringle. No other craft would serve the purpose. He sealed the letter again, burnt his fingers on the wax, and a certain pettishness at last breaking through, he cried, "Hell, death and damnation!" "Is that you, sir?" asked Harding, looking through the door. "I thought you was fast asleep at the George, gone ashore long ago." "No. I had to write to the Admiral first, and now I must take it to the Ringle to carry across. But then I shall sleep, my God. Sleep like a crew of hedge-pigs in an ivy tuft. Then in the afternoon I shall go to Woolcombe for a few days. Urgent family affairs. The yard will not start any important repairs till Monday, and even if they do, you know as much about the barkey's needs as I do. Give me the letter, sir. I'll see to it. The sooner you're abed, the better if you're to make a journey. Sleep, God help us, nothing like it. I shall turn in myself in 20 minutes. Goodbye, sir. Sleep very well, and you'll wake a new man." Jack slept in his bath, slept in his bed at the George until noon, slept in the post-chaise that carried him towards Woolcombe at so handsome a pace that it would have been the fastest run he had ever made from Plymouth, but for a linchpin that slipped from its place, liberating the corresponding wheel, which bowled away at a great pace down the road, whilst the chaise plunged into a ditch. A harmless plunge into a soft, well-filled ditch. This took place just outside Alton, a village not 5 miles from home. But by the time wheel, horse, baggage and postillion were reassembled and the chaise hoisted upright, it was dark, and Jack decided to spend the night at the Cross Keys, an inn kept by a former boatswain. Here he supped nobly and slept again, a deep, deep sleep, perfectly limp and relaxed until the first dawn woke him. He rose up a new man indeed, not exactly cheerful, but curiously sanguine. The chaise was not ready. The wheel needed a few more hours, but there was a respectable horse, and having snatched an early breakfast, he mounted and set out, the sun just over Alton Hill. Quite what was in his mind as he rode into the stable-yard he hardly recalled. But a first cold, cold shock was the sight of his daughter Charlotte, a leggier child than when last he saw her. She was in the kitchen doorway, staring. Her face expressed no sort of pleasure. She shouted back into the house, presumably to her sister, "It's Papa!" and vanished. George came running out, however, as Jack gave the horse over to Harding, and bade him a perfectly unaffected friendly, "Good morning, sir, how do you do?" "And a very good morning to you, George, my dear. Where's your mamma?" "They ain't down yet, sir. I believe they're drinking tea upstairs. But, sir, if only you'd come 5 minutes earlier, you would have seen Cousin Diana's new coach. Oh, such a beauty! She's gone to Lyme with Mrs. Oakes and Bridget. I love them so much." Up the stairs, and they creaking with his weight and haste, the room opened to the east, and the cool morning light fell full on Sophie and her mother as they sat side by side copying letters. Neither had dressed. Sophie had not yet done up her hair. She was wearing the sort of gown that women clutch about their throat. She was not looking at all her best. Yet it was neither a lack of bloom nor of colour that struck him, but rather the presence of some quality he had never seen in her at any time. Both women started, sitting upright from their papers as he came in. Mrs. Williams continued the movement, and clapping a hand to her head, rose up and ran out. She could no more be seen without a cap than without any upper garment at all. "What are you doing here?" asked Sophie, and her voice, like her expression, might have been her mother's. "Bellona's in dock for repairs, said Jack, and I've come to spend a few days at home." "Not with my good will,"
she replied. "But above all, I've come to ask your pardon. To say I'm very sorry indeed, and to beg you will forgive me." The door behind Sophie opened a little. "Not with my goodwill," she repeated mechanically. "I shouldn't have been here, but the Admiral will not leave before his term." She put her hand to a falling swag of hair, and speaking in a hurried voice, she said, "Here, look here, all these are her letters, your mistress's letters. And here is the ring you gave me before God's altar, before God's altar. And you come here to this house." "Oh, Sophie, my dear," he said gently, coming a little nearer and looking her in the face. Mrs. Williams opened the door. He clapped it to and shot the bolt. She could be heard scrabbling the other side. "Oh, come, Sophie," he said again. But she cried out that he should never have come here. It was most improper, most indelicate, and that he must go away at once. Some of this was less than coherent, but there was no mistaking the vehemence of resentment. He fell back and said, "Is that indeed all you have to say to me, Sophie?" "Yes, it is," she cried, "and I never want to see you again." "Then be damned to you for a hard, ill-natured and pitiless, unforgiving shrew," he said, anger rising at last. And he walked out, leaving her, bowed over the miserable letters, utterly appalled by his words and by her own. Chapter 7 2 days after the dark of the moon, Jack Aubrey, worn thin with his ceaseless efforts to make the dockyard work double tides, brought his ship with her sullen crew, bloated, blotch-faced, dissipated and bleary-eyed after so long in port, within sight of the offshore squadron. He made his number, and he was called aboard the flagship at once. The captain of the fleet received him with the words, "Well, you've had a fine run ashore, Aubrey, upon my word. And I see the yard did you proud in the article of spars. And I'm sorry to tell you that the Admiral is far from well, very far from well. And I understand you're to see his secretary." Mr. Craddock, like most secretaries to admirals with an important command, was a discreet, capable, middle-aged man, thoroughly used to dealing with diplomatic and official correspondence, and with matters to do with intelligence. He said that, although Lord Stranraer had indeed received Captain Aubrey's letter and report sent by the Ringle, he had seen fit, because of confidential information received, to detain the tender for a certain period, and to send her to the place of rendezvous some time earlier than the appointed date. The Ringle had not yet reported back to the squadron, and it was not impossible that Dr. Maturin, perhaps carrying important dispatches or information, might have directed Mr. Reed to take advantage of the very favourable breeze to carry him to the Downs. Captain Aubrey bowed, hoped that the Admiral was at least tolerably comfortable, and wondered whether he had made any observation on the Bellona's parting company or on the taking of a prize. "There's a matter quite outside my province," said the secretary in an impersonal tone, "but I'm sure that Captain Calvert will have directions for your immediate proceedings." He had, of course. And although he too declined to be drawn about the Bellona's inability to make out the signal to tack, he did say, "As far as the prize is concerned, and I give you joy of her, I'm sure, she sounds a genuine stunner, he is perhaps the only flag officer in the service who would have been totally unmoved. He's not interested in money." Jack had heard this before. It formed part of the Admiral's reputation. Certainly he had an ample fortune, and at sea he lived very quietly, entertaining no more than was strictly necessary, yet this didn't square with his passion for enclosing larger and larger tracts of common land, fens, and open pasture. Pending Lord Stranraer's recovery,
And, as Craddock said, they longed for the return of Dr. Maturin, in whom the Admiral had so much confidence. Jack was returned to the inshore squadron. Even at this late stage of the war, with Wellington well north of the Pyrenees, established on the Garonne and ready to push north, there was always the possibility of the French fleet, seizing the opportunity of a brisk northeast wind, breaking out of Brest, conceivably defeating Stranraer's divided force in two separate battles, and, if this coincided with one of Bonaparte's astonishing recoveries by land, reversing the whole course of the war, or, at any rate, of ending it for themselves in a blaze of glory. In the meanwhile, Captain Aubrey was to resume his patrolling under Captain Fanshawe's orders, but at the same time he was to pay particular attention to the surveying of stated parts of the coast, and above all to the fixing of the position and depth of a number of submerged rocks, such as that upon which the Magnificent was lost, totally lost, in 1804. A man could scarcely have been much lower in the spirits than Jack Aubrey. Yet it was striking to see how he plunged back into life at sea, a hard life, particularly at this season and in Brest Bay, but one with a set pattern he'd known from boyhood, and one in which he had a task that gave him deep satisfaction. He'd always liked surveying, and now he gave himself up to his submarine rocks with a conviction that settling their bearings was an absolute good. "Perhaps Stranraer feels the same about enclosure," he reflected, squaring himself in the boat and peering through the rain-misted sights of his azimuth compass at the boys tossing 5 fathoms above the top of that cruel rock, the Buffalo. "Mr. Mannering, note 137 degrees east." In most commissions, the midshipman's berth yielded a boy or two who really liked navigation, sea mathematics, and who began with unconcealed delight to seize the underlying principles. Mannering was the most recent, with the same zeal, earnestness, and growing enthusiasm. He was a comfort to Jack. So, on a very different scale, was the appearance of the Ringle, beating steadily into the usual sou'wester. Very soon a telescope made it apparent that Stephen was not on board. Jack had hardly expected him. But he did take pleasure in Reed's account of their splendid run up to the Downs. 8 or 9 knots most of the time, with points of an estimated 14 when the tide was with them, never a dull moment, the doctor in his highest form. The splendid run had brought the doctor ashore so soon, and the mail coach had whirled him up to London at such a pace, that there was time to leave a note for Sir Joseph at the Admiralty, begging that they might sup together at their club that evening. And this, a full 2 days and a half before he'd thought it possible. He took a room at the club, the only one available, a little cheese-shaped affair from which, if one chose to stand up very straight and peer over the parapet, one could look down into Mrs. Abbott's well-known bawdy house. But Stephen was really more concerned with coping with his shabby clothes as well as he could do with a nail-brush, while his dirty shirt was concealed by a black neckcloth carefully spread over all. A couple of stitches of surgical neatness fixed it in place, and he went down into the hall with its fine, hospitable fire. Sir Joseph hardly kept him waiting at all. "How very glad I am to see you, Stephen," he cried. "By Warren's computation, you are already 1,000 miles from here, with the distance growing every day."
"So I should have been, by our arrangements. But I learnt something of real consequence, and since I had no carrier pigeon at hand, I thought I should bring it myself."
"What a heavenly smell! It's frying onions. The kitchen door is being repaired."
"Frying onions? Frying bacon? Sardines grilling over vine cuttings? The scent of coffee? These things, oh, how they stir my animal desires! I had no dinner. Then let's sup at once. My dear Golding, how do you do?" This to a passing member in court dress. "What shall you eat?"
Steak and kidney pudding, without the shadow of a doubt. I slaver at the very words. And you?
My usual boiled fowl and oyster sauce, with a pint of claret. And I don't mind how soon I have it. The sight of your hunger has excited mine.
They moved on to the already well-filled supper-room, and for some time they ate seriously, with few more words than, "How was your bird?" "The capital, I thank you, and your pudding." "A fine, honest piece of work," said Stephen, taking a little wishbone from his mouth. The recipe for Black's steak and kidney pudding called for larks. And this, for example, is the true skylark. Alauda arvensis, not one of the miserable sparrows you find in certain establishments. When the cutting edge of appetite was somewhat blunted, they talked of their most recent captures. Moths, butterflies, beetles. Then pudding, in the ordinary sense, made its appearance. Apple tart for Stephen, syllabub for Sir Joseph.
"I had a most gratifying journey," said Stephen, lashing on the cream. "Apart from the fact that a vessel which bounds, fairly bounds over the main, fills all aboard with joy, I grudged every hour away from London. There are many things I must tell you, and I have real hopes of making your flesh creep."
"Have you, though?" said Blaine, looking at him with a considering eye. "Perhaps coffee at my house might be better." They walked up a foggy St. James's Street and so to Shepherd's Market and the familiar book-lined room far from the sound of traffic.
"Have you ever met an amateur intelligence agent?" asked Stephen when they were installed with their coffee and petit four.
"You wouldn't mean Diego Diaz, would you?"
"Well, yes," said Stephen, somewhat dashed.
"Oh, one sees him everywhere. Ormac's, White's, the big dinners. He's very well with most of the women who entertain in London, and he knows a great many people. The embassy people fight rather shy of him, however, in spite of his grand connections."
"Yes, he is a little conspicuous. I'll come back to him presently, if you will allow me. For the moment, may I talk about some Chileans I met in France?"
"Please do."
"Met again, I should have said, since I was introduced to them first in Peru. They are warranted by O'Higgins, Mendoza, and Guzman, and with their friends they are interested in a renewal of our alliance, our understanding with the Peruvians, but this time an alliance directed at Chilean independence. I've drawn up an account of our conversations, of their needs and their hopes, of their resources and of their undertaking with regard to slavery. And since, unlike the Peruvian enterprise, theirs depends to a considerable degree on a naval or quasi-naval presence, I think it proper to submit these papers to you in the first place, together with their credentials and letters from our friends in those parts, in the hope that you will talk the matter over."
"I shall most certainly do so," said Blaine, receiving the packet. And looking intently at Stephen, he added, "How eager, how deeply committed do you think they are, compared with the Peruvians?"
"On the basis of my contacts with them in America and of my long, long interviews during the last week, I should say that our prospects of success are greater by perhaps a third. And as you'll find when you read my pages, they rely much more on attack and defence by sea, on the mobility conferred by even a froward ocean, as compared with the mountains and intolerable deserts of the lower western part of South America.
I look forward with the utmost eagerness to reading your account. Many of the people here who supported us last time will be enchanted."
"Dear Joseph, how kind of you to say so. You will put it into the proper Whitehall prose. Scabrous, flat-footed, with much use of the passive, will you not? I may have allowed something approaching enthusiasm to creep in." Sir Joseph poured them out some remarkably smooth, full-bodied old brown brandy, and when each had thoughtfully drunk about half a glass, he said, "There are only two things to be said against your otherwise heaven-sent coca leaves. They do diminish one's acuity of taste, and they do prevent one from sleeping. Happily, I've taken none today, though I shall do so tonight in order to digest your papers. That was a mere parenthesis, and I go on. But how very much their advantages outweigh them. The vivid intensity of reflection, the vividness of life itself, the reduction of commonplace distresses, cares, and even griefs to their proper status. And I've recently found that they enhance one's appreciation of music, particularly of difficult music, to a very high degree. They talked for a while of their sources of supply, of the difference between the leaves from various regions, possibly from different subspecies of the same shrub, and each showed the other the contents of his pouch. Then Stephen said, "May I turn to my particular friend Jack Aubrey?"
"Do, by all means," said Sir Joseph.
"Like most officers of his rank and seniority, he is, of course, deeply concerned about the likelihood of his being yellowed at a future flag promotion. Can you properly tell me anything about his prospects?"
Blaine poured more brandy and said, "Yes, I can. I wish I could say that they were better than they are, and I'm not at all sure that he wouldn't be well advised to retire as a post-captain rather than risk the humiliation of being passed over. He is, of course, a brilliant sailor, as most people would admit, but to some degree he is his own most active and efficient enemy, as I've often told you, Stephen, begging you to keep him at sea or down in the country. He so often addresses the House, speaking with authority as a successful officer, but very rarely does he say anything in favour of the Ministry. And his vote is by no means sure. As an aside, I will also say, with regard to his present difficulties in the law courts, that the legal people at the Admiralty might take a different view of defending him were he more reliable, were he a cast-iron, heart-of-oak supporter of government."
"I cannot but admit that when he gets up and speaks of corruption in the dockyards, and improper material being used on men of war, he is sometimes regrettably intemperate."
"What a gift you have for understatement, Stephen. And then again he makes powerful enemies outside the Commons. Lord Stranraer's recent dispatches have done your friend, and mine too, if I may say so, the utmost harm. Neglect of duty, leaving manoeuvres in order to chase a prize that is likely to cost him dear, splendid though I hear it was, fairly ballasted with gold dust in little leather bags. You know how this ill will arose, sure. I know that the Admiral, a most zealous encloser of land, advised his heir and nephew, Captain Griffiths, to enclose a common bordering on his estate in Aubrey's. At the last stage, Aubrey opposed the petition before the committee, and that it was thrown out. He's also said to have set the country people against Griffiths, whose stacks have been burnt, his game and deer massacred, and himself and his servants pelted in the village, so that his life there is no longer worth living. Stranraer sees this unnatural insubordination of the villagers in exactly the same light as naval mutiny, and, of course, abhors it. Stranraer's word against a serving officer carries great weight with government.
I know little about the gentleman.
He's very able, of that there is no doubt, and a great political economist. To be sure, he's made no particular name in the Navy, but that may well have been from lack of opportunity. In his youth he was unusually good-looking, and he made a brilliant marriage. A widowed lady with very large estates in her own right, far, far more important than his. It is true that they go to a son by her first marriage, or rather to his guardian, since he's an idiot. But while she lives, he controls at least 9 seats in the Commons, quite apart from the considerable number he guides by his personal influence. He speaks, and speaks very well, for the moneyed, landed interest, and his support is very much valued by the Ministry. His support in the Commons, I mean, since in the Lords the government majority is so great that his vote there hardly signifies. Has he the reputation of an honest man, a scrupulous man? He's generally much respected, I know nothing against him. But I shouldn't put my hand in the fire for any man powerful as he has been these many years. So concerned with politics and so passionate in his religion of enclosures, the country's one salvation. I ask because there was some appearance of orders coming from the Brest squadron that in the ordinary course of events would have prevented Aubrey from appearing before the committee.
Blaine raised his hands.
Oh, as for that, I can't express an opinion, of course. But I don't think any hardened politician would think such a caper anything but venial, if that. Yet scrupulous, or something less than scrupulous, Admiral Stranraer does not love Captain Jack. And his word counts. Nor does Captain Griffiths, who votes with his uncle and who inherits. Just so. But on inheriting, Captain Griffiths loses his parliamentary value entirely, and he can do no harm. His vote in the Lords is neither here nor there, and he doesn't influence a single vote in the lower house. The Stranraer estate controls no seat, no borough, and all Lady Stranraer's patronage goes elsewhere. Griffiths becomes a cipher with a coronet, and he is even more likely than Aubrey to be yellowed. I should hate to see Aubrey yellowed. So should I. I have a very real liking for him, as you know. It may not come to that.
Sir Joseph walked up and down the room.
Melville has a kindness for him, too. So is your friend Clarence. Conceivably, a sure appointment could be arranged. Commissioner, say. Even something civilian, which would put him out of the running for a flag, and then there could be no question of his being yellowed. Conceivably something hydrographical, with the possibility of recall. I know he's a famous surveyor.
Blaine sat down,
and for quite a long time they stared into the glowing fire like a pair of cats, saying nothing, each lost in his own reflections. At last Sir Joseph took the poker, and delicately prized a splitting lump of coal in two. The halves fell apart with a gratifying blaze, and sitting back he said, "You were in hopes of making my flesh creep, I believe." "So I was, too. They're somewhat diminished by your recognizing my villain right away. Yet even so you may still fall senseless to the ground. Don Diego doesn't sound a really formidable villain, does he?" "No, I cannot say he does. My impression is that of a very expensive young, or youngish, man, much given to high play, uncommon high play, at Crockford's and Brooks, eager to make political acquaintance and to ask indiscreet questions, apt to suggest deep knowledge and private sources of information. He's remarkably well introduced, and although you might think he was merely showing away when he names half a dozen dukes and cabinet ministers, in fact, they are perfectly genuine. Some may perhaps indulge him with oddments of more or less confidential information, which he retails, also in confidence, with an important air. They would do so because many people think him amiable, though foolish, and perhaps because he entertains so well. A busy creature, but not, I should have thought, of any consequence, except to women with a train of daughters to marry and an appetite for high-sounding titles and a great fortune. Am I mistaken? Pray tell me what you know about him."
"The titles, the fortune, and no doubt the amiability are as genuine as his important friends in this country, but I think this appearance of harmless foolishness is assumed. Though it may have been genuine enough some years ago, before, let's say, 1805, he is the only surviving son, begotten with enormous difficulty, after endless pilgrimages and offerings to countless altars, of a grandee, as wealthy as only a Spanish grandee and former viceroy can be, and devoted to him. His elder brother was killed at Trafalgar. Diego became the heir, and I'm told that he matured to an extraordinary extent. As far as service was concerned, he preferred foreign affairs,
but being extremely impatient of superior authority or restraint, he induced his father to arrange for the creation of yet another branch of Spanish intelligence with himself at the head. He is chiefly concerned with the naval side, his people having been traditionally sea-borne rather than horse-borne. But almost from the start he's been obsessed by the problem of double agents. "Who is not?" asked Blaine, who'd been listening with the closest possible attention. "Who indeed?" "Early in his career he was given my friend Bernard as one of his chief assistants." Sir Joseph nodded with intense satisfaction. "And between them they seized a good many people in French pay who, in the usual fashion, were persuaded to name others, so that the French connection was virtually abolished. Of our men, Diaz only caught Waller, the result of a very gross indiscretion, and Waller wouldn't talk. Nor, obviously, did Bernard produce any others. He speaks of Don Diego as a man with remarkable intuitive powers, naturally secretive, but singularly winning when he chooses, persevering, hard-working, and dogged to the last degree in his pursuit, but apt to launch into spectacular adventures without always weighing the possible cost. Though even the cautious Bernard admits that the burglaries he organized in Paris yielded astonishing results." "Oh," murmured Blaine, aware that the crisis was at hand. "Will you look at these names?" asked Stephen, handing him a slip of paper. Blaine ran through the list, muttering, "Matthews, Foreign Office. Harper, Treasury. Wotton." Then quite loud, "But Callington, Edmonds and Harris? These are our people. They're all men of standing. Yes, some of high standing. They've all been unwise enough to play cards or billiards with Don Diego. They all owe him more money, sometimes much more money, than they can easily repay. They all tell him what ministers, what important officials like you carry papers home. Don Diego's respectable lawyers in London, like his respectable lawyers in Paris, gave him the names of people, of concerns, dealing with private inquiries, with the collection, sometimes the forcible collection of debts, and with the gathering of evidence, usually of marital infidelity. These people, if not directly criminal, are in touch with criminals who, if told what to look for and if guaranteed their price, will nearly always bring the required objects or documents. On occasion, Don Diego goes with them. He justifies it by saying that only he can choose the essential papers. Perhaps so, but Bernard says it excites him, and he has known him to put on quite extravagant disguises." "So did poor Cummings," said Blaine. "He may do so on Friday, when they mean to visit you," said Stephen. "What joy! Oh, what joy!" cried Blaine. "Let us instantly put the names of half the Spanish cabinet and all their top intelligence people on our payroll." Stephen uttered his rare discordant creaking laugh and said, "It is tempting, sure. But think of the possibilities of holding him caught in the act, seen by undeniable witnesses, in possession of stolen property obtained by breaking and entering a dwelling house by night. It is capital without benefit of clergy, and has no diplomatic immunity whatsoever. Tyburn Tree, with perhaps the indulgence of a silken halter, is all he can expect. From the extreme embarrassment of his government, from his family's anguish, to say nothing of his own uneasiness, what concessions may we not expect? My heart beats so that I can hardly speak," said Sir Joseph, whose face had flashed from deep red to purple. "Tell me, my most valued friend and colleague,
how this is to be accomplished.
Why, by means of your good Pratt, the thief-taker. The excellent, intelligent Pratt, who did so much for us when poor Aubrey was taken up for rigging the Stock Exchange, the best of allies. He quite certainly knows these private inquirers, and their even less presentable associates. He was born and bred in Newgate, you recall. And once he is clear on the moral side and his own immunity, he will arrange matters according to local custom and local rates, which he knows to the last half-crown. This may cost an elegant penny.
It couldn't possibly cost too much, said Blaine, and laying his hand on Stephen's knee. Of course, you're perfectly right about Pratt. Why didn't I think of him before?
Sir Joseph Blaine's library, where he worked at night on official papers and where he kept those he often referred to in an elegant mahogany cupboard, with files arranged alphabetically, had two looking-glasses at the far end. Rather long looking-glasses in black frames, and the bottom inch or so of their back was unsilvered. They didn't really suit the room, being rather modern and even flash, but this didn't worry the bearded man, busy with the lock on the mahogany cupboard by the desk. He'd never been in the room before. He'd never seen the mirrors, nor the specimen cases with their wealth of beetles, nor the perfectly enormous bear that stood against the wall, with one paw out to receive a hat or an umbrella, under a stuffed platypus to the left of the desk.
"Oh, do get on with it,"
muttered Stephen Maturin, watching through a hole in the wall exactly behind the unsilvered glass, as the man gently, silently tried skeleton keys by the discreet light of his dark lantern. Sir Joseph, also standing in the darkened passage behind the corresponding hole to the other glass, felt the rising strength of a sneeze, and to master it he contorted his purple face, pressed his upper lip, and closed his eyes. When he opened them again, the man had opened his dark lantern a little, and from the files he drew a fat document. At this, the bear flung off its head, drew a crowned truncheon from its bosom, and in a shrill, squeaking voice said,
"In the king's name, I arrest you."
The room was filled with light, with people running. Dark Lantern was pinned, handcuffed, and in the struggle his foolish beard fell off.
"I will not appear," said Stephen, shaking Sir Joseph's hand.
"May I inflict myself on you for breakfast?"
"Do! Do, my dearest fellow," cried Blaine, laughing for joy. "What a coup! What a coup! Oh, dear Lord, what a coup!"
Chapter 8. It was, indeed, the most glorious coup, the completest thing. The other intelligence service gazed at Sir Joseph with admiration, respect, unspeakable envy, and did their very utmost to gather any scraps of credit that might be lying neglected, a vain attempt if ever there was one, for Sir Joseph, though a mild and even a benevolent man in ordinary life, and charitable, was perfectly ruthless in the undeclared civil war that is so usually fought with all the outward form of politeness between agencies of this kind, and he gathered every last crumb for his own concerns, his own colleagues and advisers. But so glorious a coup couldn't be exploited to the full without a grave expense of time. And it was long before Dr. Maturin was called before the committee to be told that the Chilean proposals, as they were put forward in his minute of the 17th, had been read with considerable interest, and the preliminary discussions and even the first material preparations could go forward, so long as it was clearly understood that at this stage His Majesty's government was in no way committed to any agreement, that the whole undertaking was to be conducted privately,
in a vessel that did not form part of the Royal Navy, but only in craft hired for hydrographical purposes by the appropriate authority or authorities, and that any contribution should not exceed 75% of the very, very considerable sum left by Dr. Maturin in South America at the end of his last journey. It was agreed on both sides that this was a merely tentative understanding, one that could be put in motion at the time thought proper by both sides, or that could be relinquished by either on reasonable notice. During this period he was staying at the Grapes, an agreeable, old-fashioned inn, a quiet place in the liberties of the Savoy, where he had a room of his own the whole year round, and where his two goddaughters, Sarah and Emily, lived with his old friend, Mrs. Broad. They were as black could be. He'd brought them from a small Melanesian island, all of whose other inhabitants had died of the smallpox brought by a whaler, and their hair was naturally frizzled. But they gave no sign of being foreign, uneasy, or ill at ease, as they ran about the lane or fetched a hackney coach from the Strand. They'd picked up English with extraordinary ease, and very early in their voyage from the Pacific, a long, long voyage with a long, long pause in New South Wales and Peru, they had perceived that it possessed two dialects, one of which, the racier, they spoke on the forecastle, and the other on the quarterdeck. Now they added variations on a third, the right Cockney, as it was spoken from rather above Charing Cross down the river past Billingsgate to the Tower Hamlets, Wapping, and beyond. This they picked up mostly in the streets, and at their primitive little school in High Timber Street, kept by an ancient, ancient priest, a Lancashire Catholic, who called them thee and thou, and taught reading, writing in a beautiful hand, and arithmetic, and attended by children of every colour, as Mrs. Broad observed, except bright blue. Theirs was a busy life, for they not only learned cooking, particularly pastry, shopping in the city markets with Mrs. Broad, and turning out rooms with almost naval thoroughness with Lucy, but fine sewing, too, from Mrs. Broad's widowed sister Martha. Furthermore, they often ran errands for the gentlemen who stayed at the Grapes, or fetched a coach. These services were rewarded, and when the rewards reached 3 and 4 pence,